Good morning, colleagues. Thank you for joining us here at the UN office at Geneva today, Friday, the 15th of May, another very important, another heavy agenda. We'll have the situation, the humanitarian crisis, and the situation of children in Somalia. We have colleagues joining us also to speak to a report that just came out on Sudan concerning hunger and famine, and the situation in Ukraine. We have a guest with us here who is going to speak to the health situation in Ukraine, as well as a number of announcements. So without further ado, I'm going to throw immediately to Mr. George Conway, who's the UN resident and humanitarian coordinator and deputy special representative to the UN Secretary General for Somalia. He's joining us from Nairobi. So over to you, Mr. Conway.
Thank you. Good morning, colleagues, and grateful for this opportunity to brief. We've just had, as mentioned, updated food insecurity figures for Somalia released, which indicate a deeply worrying situation. From this data, we have five key takeaway messages. First, the humanitarian context in Somalia is worsening faster than we originally projected and expected. And right now, around 6 million people in Somalia, nearly one in three, are facing serious hunger, meaning that they're skipping meals or going days without enough food. Following a protracted multi-seasonal drought, we are entering into a new rainy season called the Gu, but the rains have been erratic and conditions are deteriorating rather than improving. Looking ahead, food insecurity is expected to remain extremely high over the next months, with a very real risk of further deterioration if these types of shocks continue. Second, the situation is a result of multiple compounding shocks, the combination of which is escalating the human impacts. In addition to the cumulative impacts of increased frequency and intensity of climate shocks, including drought and erratic rains, ongoing conflict and insecurity across the country, and repeated disease outbreaks, Somalia is experiencing spiking food and fuel prices due to the crisis in the Middle East, and a precipitous drop in humanitarian assistance reflecting global trends. Our current response, as it stands right now for this year, is funded at approximately 15%. Together, these factors are eroding people's ability to cope, to recover, and pushing more families into crisis and triggering large-scale displacement. Looking ahead toward the rest of this year, a strengthened El Nino phenomenon could further compound this crisis over the course of the next months. Thirdly, children are paying the highest price. Nearly 2 million young children are acutely malnourished, meaning they're dangerously undernourished and physically weakened, placing them at high risk of illness or death. Of these, almost 500,000 are so severely malnourished that they require urgent treatment to survive. This outlook is particularly concerning, as malnutrition levels are expected to remain very high and could worsen during the current season. Fourth, we have confirmed a real and credible risk of famine in Barakaba district in southwest state of Somalia. Conditions are already severe in the district with high levels of hunger and child malnutrition. And analysis shows that famine could occur if conditions continue to worsen and if the rains continue to be erratic. Food prices are, in the current global context, continuing to rise, and humanitarian assistance is not currently at scale to reach the most in need. So this is a critical warning, as current trends suggest deterioration rather than improvement. And finally, noting the previous comment in particular about the risk of famine in Barakaba, we have a window of opportunity to prevent the worst outcomes. With rapid and scaled up humanitarian action now, famine can still be averted. There's a narrow but critical window of opportunity in the coming weeks to prevent famine in Barakaba and other high-risk districts. And the analysis makes clear that while famine is not yet occurring today, it could develop if conditions deteriorate further, meaning that timely action now could change that trajectory. To prevent the worst case scenario, three priorities are essential: rapidly scaling up humanitarian assistance, particularly food, nutrition, health, and water services to reach the most vulnerable. Second, stabilizing access to food, including mitigating the impact of rising prices on poor households. And third, sustained response capacity and ongoing monitoring in hotspot areas to detect and respond quickly to further deterioration. With these measures and increased funding to support them, current assistance levels will not be enough to worsen ongoing food gaps, rising malnutrition, and increasing mortality risks. Thank you very much, and very happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Conway. Focusing on the children's situation, I'm going to turn to Ricardo, and then afterwards we'll take questions from all speakers, and of course Jens is also here to respond. Ricardo.
Thanks, Roland. Good morning, everyone. It will be a little bit repetitive, but I'll try and focus more on the messaging around children, because as always, they pay the highest price in any crisis, and that's not no different in Somalia. In Somalia today, hunger is no longer only about empty stomachs. It's about a fight for children to survive disease, displacement, and the collapse of basic services. Almost one third of the population will face acute food insecurity between April and June 2026. Nearly 1.9 million people are already in emergency levels of hunger. That number has tripled in less than a year. And now famine risk has emerged in southwest Somalia if humanitarian aid cannot scale up and if drought and economic shocks worsen further, which is expected. Children are carrying an enormous share of this crisis. This year alone, around 1.9 million children under five are expected to suffer acute malnutrition across the country. Nearly 500,000 children are projected to suffer severe acute malnutrition, the deadliest form. These are children at imminent risk of death if they do not receive urgent treatment. And hunger never travels alone. Malnutrition is colliding with disease outbreaks, including measles and cholera, while health systems weaken under enormous pressure. Measles cases doubled during the first 3 months of the year compared to the same period last year. At the same time, more than 630 health facilities are already at risk of closing or scaling down.
Let's just hold and pause. Let's just see if we can correct that speaker issue. Is it okay? Okay. Sorry, go ahead.
In practical terms, this means more mothers walking for hours to reach treatment that no longer exists. It means more children arriving too late for care. In Somalia, severe acute malnutrition is no longer only a nutrition issue. It is becoming a death sentence for children when clinics close, disease spread, and families cannot reach help in time. The crisis is also being worsened by global economic shocks. Fuel prices in Mogadishu more than doubled within days following the escalation of the Middle East crisis. The cost of transporting life-saving nutrition supplies has surged. Water trucking, nutrition treatment, and health outreach operations are still becoming dramatically more expensive at the exact moment needs are rising. At the same time, 3.5 million people remain displaced across Somalia, many of them children. For millions of children, displacement is becoming a permanent part of childhood. Somalia knows famine too well. Famine is not a sudden event. It is the result of many warnings ignored. Today, the warnings are once again clear. The world cannot wait for images of dying children to spread and appear on screens before acting. We need urgent funding now to keep clinics open, scale up nutrition treatment, sustain water systems, and reach vulnerable families before conditions deteriorate further. That window to prevent a deeper catastrophe is still open, but it's closing fast. Thank you.
Thank you for those powerful briefings, Mr. Conway. Ricardo, we'll take questions now from your colleagues, starting, if any, in the room. Yes, Nina, AFP.
Yeah, thank you very much for the briefings. I was wondering, obviously, Ricardo, you were talking about this being a death sentence. Are we already seeing children dying, or is it something that's looming? And then what indications have you received that this is going to, that countries might take advantage of this window of opportunity? How quickly do you think it will close? And yeah, thanks.
Thanks for the question, Nina. We don't have exact numbers now, but I can check in with my country office to make sure I can provide you with that data in terms of children already dying of severe acute malnutrition. But we are extremely concerned in pockets of the country where, again, the health they require is no longer available or the health systems are strained. And again, our supplies might not be moving fast enough due to all the disruptions that are happening in the Middle East, which so far haven't impacted heavily our operations, but we are very concerned about delays in RUTF arriving to impacted areas, and also other supplies that are important to prevent children from dying from severe acute malnutrition. We're also concerned about the fact that things are not moving fast enough, and that we're not, again, getting the attention we need, given all the crises that are happening in the world. So I don't have any indications that that window of opportunity that we have to prevent the worst is being taken, and that our partners or governments are acting fast enough. So this is indeed a call for international community to step up quicker, because otherwise we will see this great crisis being measured again in children's lives.
Thank you so much, colleagues, and your role thereon is invaluable. So try to get the word out. So thank you so much, Ricardo. Further questions? Go ahead. We do have one online, but let's go back to you, Nina, then we'll take a question from Nick, New York Times.
I guess just a quick one for both of you on the disruptions mentioned, and if you have any concrete examples of sort of how that's impacting the delivery of aid, the disruptions from the Middle East war. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Conway?
Thank you, Nina, for the question. I mean, very concretely, the price of fuel in Mogadishu and elsewhere in Somalia has more than doubled in the aftermath of the crisis. Inflation and food prices, broadly speaking, Somalia is very import dependent, and a lot of the imports do come from the Middle East, have increased variably about 20%. Given the drought situation and the drying up of water points, a lot of communities are reliant on water trucking, and the cost of water trucking obviously increases with the price with the cost of fuel. So in some locations, we've seen water prices for water trucking triple over the course of the past month. The impact on Somalia has been immediate. And widespread. Shipping has decreased by an estimated 49% as against last year, and that impacts on basic commodities available in the markets as well. Implementing partners and organizations are indicating, as a result of all this, quite a spiked cost of doing business as well, with some reporting an increase of up to 40%. For their implementation costs on the ground. Thank you.
Yeah, from our side, we're very concerned about the rising costs of fuel, but also of moving the supplies themselves. For example, we depend a lot, obviously, on ready-to-use therapeutic feeding to treat malnourished children. And with this projection that was just mentioned, this is critical. It's a matter of life or death for them. And the cost of air freight has increased significantly since the Middle East crisis, to a point that it is of grave concern for us looking at the mid and long term. And this is because we do have localization of RUTF production. We have a factory in Nairobi, for example, that produces a lot of the RUTF that we provide for Africa and other countries. But Somalia is a specific case whereby moving these supplies by road is not as feasible, and we depend on air freight. And obviously, with the fuel rising, the fuel prices rising so significantly, that cost will become very complicated for us to manage looking forward. So we're really looking at a potential catastrophic scenario here, and that's why this warning is so important.
Absolutely. Okay, let's take a question from Nick, New York Times.
Yeah, thank you. Bunch of questions, please. Ricardo, can I just be clear, you're saying that children are already dying of starvation or associated diseases from that? I wasn't clear from your answer to Anina. And question to you or to George Conway, could you just remind us what some of the financial numbers here? You say you're 15% funded, 15% of what? We hear now, you know, the United States and Tom Fletcher saying $1.8 billion is available now to OCHA, new emergency funding. Is any of this coming to you? And if not, why not? Or is it all going, I think we're going to hear about Sudan later, but is there competition of crises here that is just squeezing Somalia out of the picture? Thank you.
Thanks for that, Nick. Just to clarify, no, we don't have numbers of children dying of severe acute malnutrition yet. Well, we do have the projection of how many are expected to suffer from it this year. But again, if we don't act immediately, those numbers will start coming. It's just a matter of time. So this window cannot be missed. And in terms of the funding, I don't have a concrete answer for you on that. Thank you.
Maybe, Mr. Conway, could you address that as well, and as well as the second part of the question? Over to you.
Yeah, absolutely. No, thank you for the question. The total planned requirements for this year, based on what we then knew to be the situation, which had estimated 4.8 million people in need, was a financial requirement of $852 million to mount the level of response to address prioritized populations. The number of people in need has increased. As we mentioned, the 6 million people currently in food security crisis means that number is, you know, the needs are actually quite higher. But when we say 50% funded, that's against the annual request in the humanitarian needs and response plan that was put out at the beginning of the year. On the $1.8 billion contribution that would have to go to OCHA Geneva for feedback and comment. My understanding is Somalia has not been included in the priority countries that have been defined in that contribution, neither in the original $2 billion contribution, nor in this additional 1.8. Whether this is due to global competition amongst crises, which of course does exist, we know the overall figures of people in need globally. It is a very challenging situation across the world with multiple crises competing for attention. But this is why this particular data input and our current highlighting of Somalia's risks and threats right now is so important. Thank you.
Indeed. Thank you very much, Mr. Conway. I think we do have another question, AFP again.
Sorry, I just wanted to clarify because I think you said 15% and 50%. I wasn't sure which one it was.
Yeah, 15%. Sorry if my speech wasn't clear.
1.15, yeah.
1.5. Yeah. 1.5%.
Thank you very much. I think that does it for, well, no, I think, sorry, Nick, New York Times has a quick follow-up, perhaps. Go ahead, Nick.
Yeah, this is, since Jens is on the podium, why is Somalia not an emergency country? Why is it not a priority country, given the emergency that we're hearing about? Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. Sorry. Thank you, Nick. For OCHA and the UN, Somalia is definitely a priority country and top of the list of the crisis that we are looking at. I will refer to what was said and what was shared yesterday regarding the second tranche of money from the United States that will be channeled through the OCHA-managed pooled funds. Thank you.
Thanks for that, Jens. Okay, I think it does it for the questions on Somalia. Mr. Conway, thank you so very much for joining us here, and please do so whenever the opportunity arises, and of course, Ricardo as well. And thank you, Jens. We'll now shift to, we're staying on the continent of the African continent. We're going to move to the situation of food insecurity in Sudan. We have three briefers to speak to the release of the IPC report, which came out yesterday. We have Mr. Ross Smith of WFP, Rain Paulson of FAO, and Lucia Elmi of UNICEF joining us from Rome and New York, respectively. So, Ross, we'll start with you. I believe Mr. Smith is connected, yes?
Yes, I'm connected. Can you hear me now?
Yep, go ahead. Perfect, go ahead.
Okay, David, thanks very much, and thanks for the opportunity to be here this morning to talk about the situation in Sudan, the recent IPC report, and I'm pleased here to be here with my colleagues from UNICEF and FAO. The latest IPC results confirm what we are seeing on the ground every day in Sudan. Hunger is not only widespread, but it is deepening. Nearly 19.5 million people are now facing crisis levels of hunger, and some already in catastrophic conditions. We have multiple areas at risk of famine in the coming months. Famine has been stalking families in Sudan for far too long, and sadly, this shows no sign of abating. I will say that this is not a sudden shock. It is a crisis that's now in its fourth year. It's driven by the conflict, it's driven by mass displacement, and by the systematic erosion of people's ability to feed themselves and to earn a livelihood. Families have exhausted every coping mechanism they have. We have seen market collapse in many parts of the country, and agricultural production has been severely disrupted in some parts. Access to food is increasingly out of reach for millions of households. At the same time, humanitarian operations are simply unable to match the scale of need. Insecurity, bureaucratic impediments, and attacks on supply routes, just to name three, are preventing aid from reaching millions of people who urgently need it. For us, for WFP, the priority is clear. We must scale up food assistance now, ahead of the lean season, when conditions are expected to deteriorate further. We have been on the ground responding, we continue to be, but we are ready to do more. However, we can't do it alone. Reality is stark. Funding is far below what is required, and access to the most vulnerable must be improved. And for that, the fighting must stop. The crisis won't stabilize on its own, and it will not improve without sustained access. It will also not be solved without a political solution. And that's a solution that is years overdue. So today we're calling for three things. The first is immediate scale up of funding to sustain and to expand humanitarian assistance for WFP, for UNICEF, for FAO, and for our partners. Second is unhindered humanitarian access to all affected areas. And third is we need a renewed and a redoubling of the political efforts, the diplomatic efforts to end this conflict. Without these, I think the trajectory is quite clear. We're seeing it in the numbers. We're seeing more hunger, more suffering, and a growing risk of famine. So thank you, and I will turn to my colleague from UNICEF, Ruchi.
Thank you very much, Ross. Maybe we'll start with Rain Paulson first, and then we'll go to Lucia. Rain from FAO, sorry.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you for the opportunity to brief today on the headlines of this important report from IPC that was just released. And so to complement some of the elements that Ross just shared, one of the pieces made very clear by this updated IPC analysis is that the hunger crisis in Sudan is not just about food availability right now, it's also about the food systems that are sustaining people's lives. And when we think about the impact that the years of conflict now have had on agriculture and rural livelihoods in conflict affected areas, the consequences are substantial and in many cases devastating. Productive assets have been destroyed. Farmers have been displaced from their land. Markets have been disrupted or are inaccessible to people. Basic infrastructure, productive infrastructure, water systems, storage, transportation severely damaged in these conflict affected areas. And so this combination of supply chain disruptions, input shortages, reduced agricultural production and missed planting seasons in these conflict affected areas have led to a sustained increase in food prices. And as Ross was mentioning, we are rapidly approaching lean season and a particularly acute point of time in the calendar. So urgent action is needed. That's clearly the call that comes through this revised analysis. Saving lives through food assistance and nutrition support is vital. We need also to help the most vulnerable people to have food by helping themselves to plant, to harvest, and to be able to sustain their families. This means, in short, delivering seeds, tools, animal health services, and support to keep local food production alive. It's a vital life-saving priority at this time. And time is critical. If we miss key agricultural seasons, the consequences we know will extend far beyond just this year. So again, what is required now to change the direction? What we urgently need collectively is heavy and sustained investment in the multi-sectoral response that's underway. And within that, I'd highlight the need for emergency food production and livelihood support to be to also be prioritized. As Ross was saying, humanitarian access at scale in conflict-affected areas is vital. And let me just close with underscoring the fact that peace is a prerequisite for food security and that the right to food is a basic human right. And thank you for the opportunity to brief today, and I look forward to questions later.
Thank you so very much. Now we'll throw to Lucia Elmi, who's UNICEF's Director of Emergencies, joining us from New York. And thank you very much for this. I know it's very early in the morning for you, but important to hear your voice. So over to you.
Thank you, and good morning, everyone. And thank you for having us together with the colleagues from the FAO and WFP. We work very closely together. We will continue to do so, and particularly in this very dire situation in Sudan. Sudan now continues to face one of the world's largest and most severe hunger crises, and children are at the center of it. The latest IPC analysis that shows that nearly 19.5 million people, or 2 out of every 5 people across Sudan, as my colleagues have already said, are now facing high levels of acute food insecurity. More than 5 million people are in emergency level of hunger, while nearly 135,000 people are already facing catastrophic conditions. For children, the situation is particularly alarming. UNICEF estimates that around 825,000 children are under the age of 5 are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition this year, the deadliest form of malnutrition. That is a 7% increase compared to last year and 25% higher than the pre-conflict level. Between January and March alone, more than 98,500 children were admitted to treatment for a severe acute malnutrition. Those are children whose immune systems have been pushed to the brink, children who became dangerously vulnerable to diarrhea, cholera, measles, malaria, and other diseases that continue to spread across the country. In many parts of Sudan, conflict, displacement, and collapsing of services are combining into a deadly cycle for children. Around 40% of health facilities are non-functional. 17 million people are lack of access to safe drinking water, while 24 million people don't have adequate sanitation. At the same time, families continue to be uprooted by violence. More than 8.9 million people remain displaced in Sudan. Many are trapped in the areas where humanitarian access is extremely limited or where have fled to a remote location with little access to food, healthcare, or clean water. The IPC analysis warns that 14 areas across Darfur and Kordofan remain at high risk of famine in the coming months if conflict intensifies further and humanitarian access deteriorates. This is not a crisis we can wait. Without sustained humanitarian access, increased resources, and above all, an end to violence, more children in Sudan will slip beyond the reach of life-saving assistance in weeks and months ahead. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. It's hard to imagine the gravity of the situation, but you've really helped paint this picture, which will hopefully create some sort of response. So we'll start off with any questions in the room, if any. Yes, we have AFP, Nina Larson, over to you.
Yeah, thank you very much for the update. I was wondering if you could say a little bit about the hunger gap that's quickly approaching and efforts to sort of to stock aid for that period and how that's being impacted by the current disruptions, if you have, and how that will impact on hunger at this current moment. Thank you.
Maybe Ross, if you want to start off, and colleagues, please chime in.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, indeed. I think you're referring to the rainy season that I mentioned, but you know, obviously we have a big gap in the overall response. Pre-positioning ahead of the rainy season has always been a major feature of the operations in Sudan. We are being impacted. The operations in Sudan are being impacted by the rising costs of fuel and other imported commodities from the Middle East. This is at least 25% increase on the average level in Sudan, and I have seen some figures from other parts of Sudan, some of the more remote parts, which are much higher than that. So indeed, it limits, you know, it effectively reduces the amount of coverage we have. It makes the operations more expensive. And, you know, another major factor in that prepositioning has been the lack of access to some areas. So we're just unable to preposition in some parts because of insecurity, but also because of lack of approvals to access certain supply routes. Thank you.
Thanks to you, Ross. Colleagues, if anyone wants to jump in, just maybe put your hand up. Yeah, go ahead, Rain. I think, did you want to add something? Yes, go ahead.
Please, just quickly. I think the this issue of time sensitivity and windows of opportunity is really key and comes through clearly in the analysis that was released by the IPC. And as Ross was referring to rainy season, I mean, if you think in terms of what people need to be able to plant to produce for themselves, these rains that vary a little bit by part of the country, but in this period, end of June, July, August, this is the key period for getting cereal seeds in the ground, sorghum and millet, the key staples. And we know what can be done because last year, FAO alone was able to produce more than $500 million worth of food with about $15 million worth of seeds and inputs in a number of different locations. But that was still only allowing the production of about 22% of the sorghum production that was produced nationally last year. And of course, the overall numbers are down a little bit. So the points around funding, timing, and access are absolutely indispensable, whether we're talking about emergency agriculture or other sectors. And I think that's one of the things that I hope readers and those that are following this take with them for action.
Thank you very much. Ms. Elmi, I think you wanted to add in.
Yes. As also was said for Somalia and also by my previous colleagues, the impact of the Middle East crisis is also showing up on in Sudan, particularly for the stockpiling of ready-to-use therapeutic feeding. So we're already seeing delays, the increase of prices, very similar situation of Somalia. So this is also, unfortunately, we continue to have an impact as well on our response in Sudan. It's funding, but it's access, as also Ren was saying, but it's really the impact of the overall crisis and the delays that we're already starting to see linked also to price increases.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, all three of you. Let's see if there are any further questions before we move on to the next subject. I don't see that's the case. You mentioned about, I think it was you, Elaine, who talked about the fighting to stop. That's precisely what the Secretary General has been saying since day one: cessation of hostilities, unhindered access of sustained humanitarian access, safe, unhindered passage for people also seeking to flee. So these are other very important messages in addition to yours, which you shared with us. So thank you very much on this important announcement today. And thanks for your amazing work. Ricardo, thanks for joining me here. We now will shift to the situation in Ukraine. And if I could call our guest to join me here on the podium, who I believe, Jarno, you've been here before. I think so, yes. I think also online, if I'm not mistaken. So Jarno Habicht is the Ukraine representative for the World Health Organization. And Tarek is also joining us on the podium. He's going to speak to the health situation in Ukraine. And thank you very much again for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you, and great pleasure to talk to you in person, as there are delegations coming to forthcoming World Health Assembly. At the same time in Ukraine, we witnessed yesterday the death and devastation, as there were a number of attacks to the civilian infrastructure, which has continued since the 24th of February 2022 and the Russian Federation invasion. But in addition, I like to bring to your attention the attack against the UN convoy, as the UN convoy delivering essential support to people in Kherson was attacked yesterday twice, where the OCHA and UNDSS mission was on the ground, and there is more information. But what it means is that humanitarians are not safe, as well as many Ukrainians across Ukraine, and we need to continue this essential work. But as the war continues, at the day of 1,541, I like to bring more the topic of health and public health to you, and few aspects, and particularly concentrate on six of them. First, seasonality and health. We are out of the cold winter, where it has been essential to ensure that the hospitals and primary care centers have power, heating, water, to ensure that there is a continuity of essential services. And over the past years, WHO has been supporting facilities and hospitals with more than 300 generators and 26 heating stations to have the heat in the hospitals. We have also installed a number of water purification centers and water tanks that the services can be provided. But now, when I have been traveling across Ukraine, being in Mykolaiv, Odessa, also in Kharkiv and Sumy, now everybody is getting ready to prepare for the next winter as the war goes on. So the seasonality is extremely important. But for public health, it's not only about winter. For us, as a public health specialist, equally important is the summer. Because due to the summer heat, war-related infrastructure damages, as well as service disruptions, we need to ensure that we are ready for the heat-related illnesses, outbreaks, and particularly waterborne, foodborne, and vector-borne outbreaks, as these will affect mostly the people living in the south and east part of Ukraine. Second, attacks on health. The attacks on civilian infrastructure and the impact across the whole country has been there for years long. But just last week, we passed 3,000 attacks on health mark. It means two attacks per every day. And this is putting in risk having access to care. We have lost a number of healthcare workers. And since 24th of February 2022, this has caused 239 deaths and 991 injuries, where every fifth attack is against ambulances and medical transport. So those who are going to save others are actually putting their lives in risk every day. We have seen intensified attacks on health since 2024. As we enter to the 26th, this has continued. The third I like to bring to you is health of people. The war has devastating effect to health of people. Now, if we compare to the time before the war, two out of three people will say that their health has worsened through this war and during the over 4 years in the past. Every second person in the past year has said that their health has deteriorated related to the sleep disorders, having headaches and migraines, anxiety, depression, and PTSD. The cumulative stress and also the past 4 years' disruption in the health system has manifested also in increase of chronic diseases. And why I'm talking about that is extremely important aspects of human capital, because these are the people who are at the same time living and in Ukraine and also there to contribute to the development. We have seen in hospital admissions 11% increase of strokes and 7% increase in myocardial infarctions. And we notice that health situation is commonly worse among those who are looking shelter, those who are the internally displaced, who have been pushed out from their homes. And these are millions of people within Ukraine, more than 3 million, and we see that their health situation is worse. Fourth, I wanted to mention the adaptation, because the health system in Ukraine is working, but it is adapting to this very volatile and very violent environment which is there around. When we have surveyed a population, we see that 68% of people have visited their primary care. And it's very similar to our own countries in the West and other parts of the world where there are no wars. And 85% of people say that they are satisfied with the quality of services they are getting. So we need to put these two sides together. There are attacks on health, but the health system is functioning. But healthcare workers are under constant risk. So in that environment, also Ukraine is introducing new vaccines, ensuring that the services are provided, and ensuring that also services are provided in the front line. So a few words as a fifth on WHO's actions. There are a lot that we have been doing, as well many partners, and I'd like to thank everybody who has been very busy in the last years. As WHO, we have delivered 320 metric tons of medical supplies to the hard-to-reach areas. These are done together with the UN convoys, 41 convoys last year. And as I started, I mentioned these convoys have been attacked as of yesterday. As well, the WHO, WFP, and UN convoy was attacked also in October last year. But we need to continue to do that. And WHO has been also working on our own convoys to ensure that the medicines are available for those living in the front line. Primary care has been provided to 20,000 people, and we are building back. And that's why WHO has invested to 28 modular primary care and emergency care units that have been built to provide services to 168,000 people. And this is important to have a trust to the system. Of course, the capacities need to be built on mental health, trauma care, rehabilitation, because we have 168,000 medical devices, assistive devices distributed for rehabilitation. Without war, these 168,000 assistive technologies would not have been needed. So this is the scale of the devastation and the disruption. Finally, I like to thank all the partners who are staying with solidarity, with energy, and with a focus in that new environment where we are living globally to support also the humanitarian and the development support. However, the humanitarian partners in health, we have more than 100 partners under health cluster. They have available, as of today, only every third dollar that they planned to reach 1.3 million in Ukraine. So we need to continue to ensure that the resources are there as the attacks continue and people need care. At the same time, I like to thank all the partners who are providing budget support. Because of this budget support, actually Ukrainian doctors, nurses, those who are in the ambulances have continued to work. And I like to thank those who are providing resources, but also those who have courage to do every day the work they do. And finally, I like to mention with a hope that there is a recovery and reconstruction going on that builds the trust and that allows to continuously to invest that actually the services are available. And why that is important is that means that we have the courage to work on humanitarian response, recovery, but keeping the development focus also for the future, because we don't want to leave behind those who are living currently in Ukraine and those next generations to live in Ukraine. So thank you.
Thanks to you. It was excellent and incredibly important brief. Thank you very much, Jano. See if there are any questions looking to you in the room. Yes, Nina, AFP.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. It's nice to see you. So I was just wondering, could you say a little bit more about the mental health concerns? Because you're talking about these constant attacks and the health system that's continuing to function, but it must be under an incredible strain. So how are you dealing with, I guess, especially among health workers? Thank you.
Thank you. So mental health has been a priority for many partners and also for the government. And particularly, Ukraine has launched its own all-Ukrainian mental health program under the leadership of First Lady Olena Zelenska. And we as a partners have been behind that. So first, what is important, what I have seen, the unity among the partners, both national, internationals, to work on mental health all together. And that's important because we need to support many. Now, the needs have been growing because in the beginning, if you remember our first briefs in February, March 2022, we said that we estimate that 10 million people would need support on mental health. Now, as the war goes on the fifth year, these needs have been increasing, those who need support, but also our latest data shows that 71% of people have episodes of anxiety, stress, sleepless nights. So when we look to the mental health, we see the impact now. We know that there will be impact for generations to come. So from mental health, the focus, from my personal perspective, we have work to do until end of the century. And now how we have addressed that is there are more than 150,000 healthcare workers trained in the past years in the WHO tools called MHCAP and others, which has allowed the primary care doctors and many specialists in the hospitals to provide services to people. Are we reaching to all people? No. We know that not everybody who has mental health needs reaches out to the doctors, to the caregivers, and that's why also mental health support has been integrated to all the sectors. So it's not only the work of the health sector, but equally across the many. But there is a lot of work to be done in the mental health for the coming years, and we are there to support that area.
Thank you very much. Further questions online or in the room? I don't see that's the case. I think you were very, very clear and comprehensive in your brief, so thank you again, and do come back and join us again for this update.
Thank you, and good to be in person.
Yeah, absolutely. Nice to see you. Okay, colleagues, maybe Zeina, do you want to come up? We have a few announcements. We'll start off with Zeina of ILO, and then we have an announcement as well from UNEP and WMO. But I'll turn immediately to Zeina, who's going to talk about the International Labor Conference starting next month. Yeah, please.
Good morning. Good morning, colleagues. Thank you very much. I've got two announcements to share with you today. The first one is to let you know, if you're not aware already, that on Monday we will be releasing the new Employment and Social Outlook 2026 update, which will be looking at the impact of the Middle East crisis on labor markets. The report is available under embargo. We've received a couple of requests and we'll be sharing the embargoed copy with you quite soon. On Monday, we're holding an embargoed briefing at 9:30 a.m. Geneva local time, which is until 10 o'clock in the morning. And 10 o'clock is when the embargo will be lifted on both the content of the online press briefing as well as the actual report. The briefing will be led by our ILO chief economist, Sang-Yeon Lee, along with Cher Verrick, his deputy, and Maurizio Busio, who's the director of our Action Crisis Program. And you can expect to see new estimates on potential impact on jobs, working hours, labor incomes under different energy price scenarios, depending on how long the current crisis continues. Do reach out to us, newsroom@ilo.org, and we will make sure to share with you the embargoed copy as soon as it's ready. And if you'd like to attend the online Zoom briefing, also do reach out to us, and we will make sure that you have all the information that you need. I'd also like to, it's not an announcement, it's a reminder slash re-announcement about our upcoming International Labor Conference. It's the 114th session of the ILC, and it will be held from the 1st until the 12th of June. This is our annual conference where workers, employers, and government delegates from our 187 member states come together to discuss some of the most important issues in the world of work. They will be looking at the report of our Director General and of our chairperson. They'll be looking at programming and budget and application of international labor standards. Now, there are a number of important policy themes, discussions that will be taking place, including one on social dialogue and tripartism. We'll have a second standard-setting discussion on decent work in the platform economy and a general discussion on gender equality and the world of work. The full agenda is available on our ILO website. The website is being updated slowly but surely with relevant documents and information. And you can also find the accreditation information as it relates to you on the website as well. And as always, my team and myself are available if you'd like to reach us via email. Thank you very much.
Thanks to you, Zeina. Do we have questions? Yes, sir.
Sorry, accreditation information. So we won't have access with our UN badges?
You will have access to your UN badges, yeah. But there'll be information about, I forgot to mention one important thing is that this year it's taking place on three different sites. So it's taking place here at the Palais. It's also taking place at the ILO, as well as the CICG, which is the Geneva International Conference Center. So it'd be good to just take a look and reach out if you've got any questions about any of the sites. It's an unusual setup this year, but yeah.
The badges will be good for all three locations?
They should be in principle, but do get in touch because we're still ironing out the back and forth to the CICG.
Will things be available? Can we follow online or is it only in person?
It depends. Some sessions will be streamed online and others will not be streamed online, in which case it would have to be in person.
Sorry. Okay.
No problem.
Thank you very much. Did you have another question?
Would it be possible to have some information
about
the World Office?
Yeah, I was looking at Tarek as rudely turning the other way towards my colleague in the front row. But we do have a few other announcements. Maybe if there are no further announcements for Zeina, I'm going to release her. And then maybe before we go to you, Tarek, let me just quickly throw to Alejandro and Claire, who have been waiting patiently. Thank you very much, Zeina. So Alejandro, maybe we'll start with you. Alejandro? Okay, we can't hear you. We can see you, we just can't hear you. Yeah, I think we have an issue. Is he unmuted? Yes? No, okay. Tell you what, we'll go back to you. Maybe we'll go to Claire quickly, and then we'll come back to you, maybe just to log out and then come back in. Claire Nullis of the World Meteorological Organization, announcement from you, Claire.
Okay, right. Can you see and hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, thank you. I'll be very quick. Just to say that the World Meteorological Organization on Monday, the 18th of May, is releasing its report on the state of the climate in Latin America and the Caribbean. It's one of our regional series of climate reports. We issued the one for Europe a couple of weeks ago. So this is the one for Latin America and the Caribbean. It's being released in Brasilia. I'm not sure that there's actually going to be a press conference because we're not responsible for the launch arrangements. But if you do need interviews with any of the principal authors, just please let me know and I can facilitate it. And you should have received the embargoed materials this morning in your inboxes. We're still awaiting the press release in Spanish. The full report is already available in Spanish, but all the material is also in English. So that's all I have to say. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Claire. Any questions for Claire? I think that was very clear. So thank you very much for joining us and for your patience. Okay, we're going to try again with Alejandro to see if that's working, your link. Otherwise, I'll go to Tarek for an update on the WHA. Alejandro?
I think it should work now.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Back to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Good morning. I'm here to speak to you about a report by the UN Environment Programme, UNEP, and the Global Alliance for Buildings and Construction. It's the 10th edition of the Global Status Report for Buildings and Construction from 2025 to 2026, and it's going to be officially launched next week on Tuesday, the 19th of May, at 8 a.m. Geneva time. It assesses progress across the sector, the buildings and construction sector, using several key indicators covering policies, finance, technologies, and investment aligned with global efforts, global commitments towards a 2050 net zero emissions pathway. It is very timely because it is published in the middle of a global housing and an energy affordability crisis. And it stresses how climate action in buildings can reduce energy bills, improve living conditions, and strengthen resilience to climate impacts while cutting greenhouse gas emissions. Now, there's a series of very interesting figures and percentages that I can't share now because it is under embargo, but I will at least give you a sense of what to expect to find in the report. How much are we building, or rather, how much more are we building? What is the environmental footprint of the building sector? What percentage of global material extraction does the building and construction sector account for? What about global emissions and global energy consumption? How are buildings becoming more energy efficient, and at what rate? What are buildings' operation emissions like? What percentage of buildings' energy demand is supplied by renewables at this moment, and what has the trend been? And green building certifications increasing? There's also a series of examples in many different countries across the world, positive examples related to operational emissions, emissions released before and during construction, growth in renewables, national climate action plans covering building sector strategies, etc. I'm going to stop there. As I mentioned, it's going to be launched on the 19th. We do have a set of materials, including a press release, key messages, and the report itself that can be shared with you under embargo. Thank you very much and have a good rest of the day.
Thanks to you, Alejandro. Do we have questions for Alejandro? No, I think it was very, very clear. So thanks for your intervention and, again, for your patience. So we'll go now to Tarek for the WHA. Kicking off Monday?
Yeah.
All right.
Thanks. Well, on Sunday morning, we will have a walk the talk just here in front of the UN as we had previous years. I hope you all received the media advisory we have sent last evening that has all the practical information that all reporters have to know. Also that spells out a little bit areas that will be discussed by member states from global health system to emergencies, shaping health policies, but also discussing budget, finance, and constitutional matters of WHO. We will this year exceptionally have assembly at both at Palais and at WHO. So here at Palais, we will have a plenary in Committee B, while Committee A will be in the auditorium in WHO. So there will be shuttle services that reporters may use. So for Palais journalists, your badge will be activated on the first day when you come to WHO. So you can use your badge at WHO, and it will be activated for the duration of the assembly, so until 23rd. We have, as always, a number of reporters who are accredited specifically for the World Health Assembly. They are not here today, they are not listening, but we have, again, a group of journalists who we will be following specifically. For them, the system is a little bit different, but they have been informed about that. So we at WHO, we have a, as you know, our media team is much smaller this year than previous years, so, but we will do our best to help you with whatever you may need. At the plenary, there will be dedicated press space. Usually you would have it, it was on a right side when you look from the stage. This year it will be on the left side. At WHO, there will be a press area near new press room that you can come and use. So that's it. Otherwise, as always, there will be daily journals. We will issue notes on what has happened, what has been adopted. And again, we will be there for you.
Thank you very much. And we'll be there for you as well to support, of course. Thank you very much for that announcement. Okay, maybe, Nina, we're going to go to somebody else first, if that's okay. Go ahead, Dina, and then back to you. Dina, over to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Tarek. And sorry, Nina. My question is about the accreditation. During our last meeting with Dr. Tedros, he promised to give us accreditation until the end of 2026. And I sent an email from ACANU email and a follow-up without receiving any reply from your side. I would like to follow up here today about this. And when will we receive our, or maybe activate our badges, UN badges, also at the WHO building? Thank you, Tariq.
Thank you very much. We are aware of your request. Now, again, this is a decision that will be first with our security services. So we are checking with our security services, and we will follow their advice. For the time being, so badges that are issued by UNOC can be activated very easily, as you know. It really takes a few seconds just to come to the reception, and your badge gets activated for the duration that is needed. So this time around, it will be for the duration of the assembly. But we are aware of your request. But again, this is something that has to be approved by the by our security.
Thank you. Madam Larson?
Thank you. I have a few questions on the program for next week. So first, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what timing we can expect on Monday, for starters, when we can expect Dr. Tedros to speak. I was also hoping you could say how many delegates you're expecting and how many ministers, any heads of state, if we could have an overview of that and a list would be helpful. It would also be good to know, because your program doesn't really, it's quite difficult to tell when things are going to happen for planning purposes. Would it be possible to know when issues might be discussed on, for example, resolutions around the Middle East, on the Palestinian issue, on hantavirus, which I guess isn't on the program, but it would be nice to know if you, when you expect that might come up? Thanks.
Thanks, Nina. So these are exactly the same questions we get every year. And the answer is always, unfortunately, we cannot answer many of those questions right now. The list of participants will be posted. It's usually at the last moment. So we have to see with our colleagues from governing bodies when they will have that list posted. And it's changing. You know, the delegations announce, but then there are always changes. So on the first day, as you would have seen in a media advisory, so we will have a high-level welcome, opening of the assembly, election of the officers of different committees. There will be address from the president, and then there will be speech by Dr. Tedros, as always. What time? I have to check, really, but we will. What we are planning to do is every year is that we will have an email list with all the Palais reporters, plus those who are specifically accredited for the assembly. And we send you things as we get to know. So then we said, hey, look, we expect the Dr. Tedros speech at this particular time. Or we expect the discussion on this particular point at that time. It's really moving. But just stay with us. You know that we can't really predict how long discussions will go on certain items. And then it can be that items are moved either forward, but more... more usually they are moved to later stage. But again, we will do our best. So journals are a good thing to look in the morning. It gives you really the orientation, what's going to happen that day. And then you just call us, and then we will try to get. Again, it really doesn't. A lot of these things do not depend on WHO. It depends on the discussions of member states. So it's not us deciding that item will start at 11 o'clock.
Sorry, but just on some of the specific issues, generally you have some kind of idea when maybe resolutions might be discussed or when there's a specific day for...
Yes. Look at the agenda. There is agenda is posted, so it's not daily journal is something that is a little bit more precise, but agenda is already there, so you can look at it. I don't have it here in front of me.
Okay, I think... All right. Thanks. I'm sure there'll be a lot more information to come. There's another question for you. Don't move just yet. Isabel, Efe.
Hey, good morning. Thank you, Tariq. We all know that you and the WHO press team do a lot of efforts to keep us informed. You may, as Nina said, what is important for us, for especially, you know, for agencies, but because we cannot catch, we need inform to be, to follow at the moment what is happening. And as you said, everything can move at the last minute. So you may also, apart from warn us by email, you can use also maybe the ACANU contact through the ACANU Secretariat to inform us about, we have an ACANU group, and this is very useful because it's something that we see very rapidly. So you may do this also at the same time that you send the emails. I don't know if you find that this is a good idea, but the question is to be really at the last minute to be able to connect to the assembly if it's necessary. Thank you.
No, thanks. Thanks, Isabella. The thing for us is that, usually we have a platform that we send all our press releases. It's through Campaign Monitor. Now, with the assembly, it's a little bit different because we have all those people who are here just for the assembly. So we want to inform you and them at the same time. And that's why this email system worked pretty well previous years. So you receive email directly from my email address or from Christian's email address saying, hey, this is happening, or this is what we have to tell you. And I hope it will work this time as well, because we have really, literally, there's only three of us in a team now. And we have two venues, so we have to discuss. Like, one person will have to stay probably at Palais, another person have to be at a WHO. So we'll see how we can do it.
Yeah. It's not easy. We understand, appreciate the efforts for this important meeting, and I'm sure we'll be hearing from you regularly. So thanks, Tarek. Is that a follow up, Isabel?
Yes. Just very quickly. I wonder if you may have any idea if you want to organize some press briefing or technical press briefings. Like you did a few years ago for any important issue or not. Or we cannot expect that.
Well, that reminds me. I didn't mention. I didn't remind you that we have a press briefing today. So Dr. Tedros is having press briefing today at 3:00, and he will obviously talk about upcoming assembly as well, among other issues. So that's one. Next week, we have Palais briefing, so that we can come and speak. We will see. It's really during the assembly. We really have to be flexible and see what's. As situation develops, as resolutions are being adopted or there are issues being discussed, then we are flexible and to organize. But again, we have a press area, we have a stakeout area. We can, if you have followed a particular topic, we can find WHO experts for you to speak. When it comes to delegates, as always, you approach delegates and try to get information from them and their point of view.
Noted. Yep, go ahead.
Sorry, I just wanted to back up Isabel on the fact of we miss those briefings that you used to have, which were daily briefings during the World Health Assembly, where we actually got some information about what had happened during the day and what to expect the next day, because your program is very, or the agenda is very difficult to read and to understand when things are going to happen. So I know that you guys are understaffed, but it would be very helpful.
Noted. Okay, thank you, Tarek. Good luck. You can count on us for support as well. I know it's a very big event for you as well, journalists, so thanks for your reporting thereon. Okay, just a few announcements. As usual, the Secretary General statements, we'll start off with the couple that were shared with you yesterday. One speaks to the donation from the United States of $1.8 billion for life-saving humanitarian work. This was following an announcement yesterday by the U.S., so the SG responded to that. There was a message as well from the Secretary General concerning the release of more than 1,600 conflict-related detainees in Yemen, so a very welcome development, which we have a statement on. A couple of meetings taking place here. We have the Universal Periodic Review of the Human Rights Council closing its session today. This afternoon, it'll adopt 14 state reports on the reviews which took place over the last 2 weeks. So that's this afternoon. We also have another update I received from Pascal concerning another Human Rights Council-related meeting taking place starting on Monday, the 18th, 18-19-2021. So next 4 days, next week, the Working Group on the Right to Development's 27th session taking place in the Tempest Building. And this is an important gathering of the Working Group. Will continue to monitor and review progress made in the promotion and implementation on the right to development. It'll also hold an interactive discussion with the Special Rapporteur on the right to development, as well as the expert mechanism on the same subject, the right to development. So that's taking place. To consult Pascal if you have any questions. Just to mention that the Security Council on the other side of the pond is meeting this afternoon, our time, on the situation in the Middle East in a public meeting. Press conferences, we did announce it once, so I'll announce it again. Press conference at Palais Wilson, down by the lake, a very important gathering with the head of the UN Human Rights Office in the occupied Palestinian territory. Press conference, 2 p.m. 2 p.m. on this coming Monday, the 18th, with Ajit Sungay, who is the head of that office, who you know well. I have an announcement from the Secretary General's travel plans. The Secretary General this weekend will be traveling to Tokyo, where he will chair the biannual session of the UN System Chief Executive Board for Coordination, otherwise known as the CEB, which brings together heads of UN agencies, head of UN systems organizations. So the SG will also be meeting with the Emperor of Japan. I don't have the specific time, as well as the Prime Minister. Minister of Foreign Affairs will share with you, as we always do, readouts of those meetings. Mr. Guterres will also participate in a high-level symposium entitled Celebrating 70 Japan-UN Cooperation Expo 2025 and the Future of Multilateralism. Lastly, in terms of Secretary General's plans, he is expected to hold a press conference on the 20th of May. That's Wednesday. And of course, this will be in Japan, so we'll share with you the transcript as we always do. That's all I have. So, any questions? No. Thank you very much. Have a nice afternoon. See you here on Tuesday. Thanks.